Welcome to the Public Morality. In a pair of 7-2 rulings, the United States Supreme Court appeared to have delivered a split decision on subpoenas for President Donald Trump's tax returns and personal financial records, unanimously rejecting his broad claims of absolute immunity in a New York State criminal investigation, but ruling that lower courts did not do enough to scrutinize congressional subpoenas for similar records. Was this a win for President Trump, the state of New York? And moreover, was it a loss for the American people? To answer these questions and others, I'm joined once again by NYU constitutional law professor and former clerk to Justice Thurgood Marshall, Richard Pildes. Richard Pildes, welcome back to the Public Morality.
I'm very glad to be back here again. Thanks very much for having me.
Let us begin. If one simply read the headlines, they would likely believe the Supreme Court split on the subpoenas for President Trump's tax returns and personal financial records. But if one took a more nuanced view, would they reach the same conclusion about what the court actually did?
Well, I think as a matter of law, both of these decisions sort of reaffirm and help establish extremely important foundational principles, both of which basically stand for the proposition that the president is not above the law, that both Congress and state criminal prosecutors, under certain circumstances, do have the ability, if justified, to seek records from the president. I think, as the court said in one of these cases, the president is not above the law. In another case, the court said the public has the right to every man's evidence, including the president's, which is a quote from previous cases. So in terms of the principles they establish and solidify, I think they are both very strong cases for the accountability of the president to law. Now, as a practical political matter, we can talk about that separately. What these cases are going to mean on the ground over the next several months is another matter. But in terms of practical legal principle, these are very, very important cases that will set the contours for presidential accountability to law for many, many years.
Well, I wanted to talk about some of the practical short-term matters. But before I get there, I heard something yesterday. It's funny how I was preparing for this interview, and I heard someone say yesterday, and I'd like to get your thoughts on it. They said the president lost, but the presidency won. Or was it the way? I don't want to know. Did you see it that way, or is it the other way around? How do you see that?
Well, again, this goes to the difference between the legal results here and what the political consequences may be. And these are two very different cases, and we should talk about the differences. But, in one of the cases, Congress was subpoenaing the president's accountants for his business records. And the president lost on all the principles he was trying to fight for. For example, the president argued that the court shouldn't hear this dispute at all. The president also argued that he should be absolutely immune. And the Supreme Court very forcefully in these 7-2 decisions rejected those arguments. So I would say the Constitution or the rule of law or Congress's ability to hold the president accountable, all of those are what won. But it may be as a political matter that President Trump on the congressional case has effectively run out the clock, particularly if he's not reelected, because it's unlikely that Congress is going to be able to actually get the documents they want before he would leave office, if he's only there for this term. The case with the district attorney in New York, I think, is a lot more consequential potentially in terms of the political or legal ramifications, particularly in the short term. Well, because this is the first time a district attorney has brought a subpoena in a criminal action, I should say a state or local district attorney has brought a subpoena in the context of a criminal action potentially against the president. And there were questions before the court decided this case about whether the court would hold that presidents are just immune from such actions. And again, the court rejected that and said that the Manhattan DA does have the legal authority to subpoena these records, the business records, again, from the Trump organization and his accountants. And that is going to move faster, I believe, than the congressional case. The judge who's presiding in that case, which is was a state judge in New York, has already told both sides that by this Wednesday, they need to tell him whether, particularly the president's lawyers, are going to continue to contest these subpoenas and on what grounds. And I think it's pretty clear this judge intends to move quickly to address whatever remaining arguments the president might have here. I expect that case to move fast and the records most likely to be required to be provided to the Manhattan DA. Now, it's in the context of a grand jury investigation to see whether a crime or crimes have been committed. So those won't be public documents because there's secrecy with the grand jury. But if they result in an indictment, which could be an indictment of figures high up in the Trump organization, you know, which may or may not include the president, may or may not include family members, but could include other people involved in running the businesses. If there are indictments that issue, then we will see all of those records that are relevant to the criminal prosecution. And if President Trump is defeated, those indictments, if there's a basis for concluding that the president himself in his business operation had engaged in anything that's criminal under the laws of New York, that could issue that could result in an indictment of the president once he leaves office, and that might happen, you know, relatively quickly after January 20th, given the pace at which I expect this case to proceed in the state courts in New York.
Now, to be clear, in the New York case, they are not asking President Trump directly to turn over his financial records. Is that correct?
That's true in both cases. Both of these cases, the subpoenas were directed either to the accounting firm, Mazars, that actually does the accounting for the businesses, or to the Trump organization, business entities. The president himself doesn't actually have to do anything specifically to respond to these subpoenas. He doesn't have to turn over documents that are in his possession. The subpoenas are not, they don't name him as the entity receiving the subpoena. It's the businesses and the accounting firm.
You know, one of the things I have found whenever we talk about Supreme Court rulings, and I'm speaking to a constitutional law professor, so I need to hedge my words correctly here. But oftentimes we debate the issue largely on the outcome. And sometimes, to me, that could be a misnomer in that if I'm sitting here, and let's just say I want to see the president's tax returns tomorrow, and I didn't get that, it's a bad ruling. But what I'm hearing you say, those really aren't the salient issues that the Supreme Court were actually dealing with. Is that correct? How would you phrase that?
Yes, I think that's absolutely correct. The Supreme Court was facing novel issues in both these cases. So in the congressional subpoena case, the Supreme Court had never actually decided a case in which Congress had subpoenaed records of the president. And there were a lot of uncertainties about what the basic legal principles would be around such a case. And as I mentioned earlier, in fact, one important lower federal court had said that the court should not get involved in these kind of controversies at all. You know, Congress and the president both have a lot of weapons at their disposal. They can fight this stuff out. And actually, historically, that had tended to be what happened when Congress subpoenaed the president for records. There would be back and forth, negotiations, some kind of compromise reached, and these things didn't come to the Supreme Court. So when the court issues decisions on questions like this, especially when they're novel, like can a state DA bring a criminal investigation against a sitting president? Or can Congress enforce its subpoenas for the president's records? What the Supreme Court does here is establish very important principles that are going to govern, you know, these issues long into the future, as well as in this case. And that may not be the very last step in the process, right? The Supreme Court's decision doesn't determine, yes, these records must be turned over, but they establish the principles under which the next stage in this process will operate. And those principles, I think, are very favorable to Congress or a state district attorney in these contexts.
How much did U.S. v. Nixon and Jones versus Clinton play into the Supreme Court's decision here?
Yes, those are definitely the two most important Supreme Court precedents on this. In the Nixon case, as you may remember, the court held that the special prosecutor in that case did have the legal right to get the secret tape recordings that President Nixon had made in the Oval Office. And in the Clinton versus Jones case, the Supreme Court held that a civil action against a sitting president could go forward. And those were the two most important precedents that the court relied on here from the courts. Now, the other big precedent was the trial of Aaron Burr for his efforts to help Spain acquire part of the United States, where President Jefferson was subpoenaed for documents and ultimately provided those documents. Those were the three main precedents. But in terms of modern history, the Nixon case and the Clinton case were definitely the two most important precedents here. And I should just say, you know, Nixon has always stood, the Nixon case has always stood for the basic principle that the president is not above the law, that the president can be accountable to the law. And essentially that's what the court relied on in these cases in drawing from the Nixon case.
I'm going to go back to my my mythical person who wants to see the tax returns yesterday and who's upset about this ruling. And they would probably say to you, Professor Pildes, what I'm hearing the court say is Congress has subpoena power, but with some caveats. Would I be right?
Yes, right. So in the congressional case, the court laid out basically sort of four factors that lower courts are going to have to consider in deciding whether these subpoenas are valid and have to be complied with. And they're basically factors like, does Congress have a legitimate legislative purpose for looking for these documents? Is there some other way to get the relevant information that Congress has a legitimate interest in? Is there enough of an evidentiary basis for Congress's starting this investigation? And are the burdens on the president from complying with the investigation so significant that they interfere with his ability to serve as president? So the court laid out a bunch of factors, and they're going to be fought about in the lower courts. And I think the frustration you're sort of hearing from some of your listeners is kind of a frustration of how slowly the legal system can move. And I think that is a problem with the operation of the legal system, particularly on cases that have a lot of time sensitivity to them. So presidents have a certain advantage here if they resist Congress, because they can try to run out the clock. And if the process drags on long enough, they may be out of office before there's any final resolution. And once they're out of office, Congress probably doesn't have as strong a case for continuing to seek those records. Now, again, the Manhattan criminal investigation is different, because even if President Trump leaves office after this first term, that investigation, if there's a basis for concluding there's criminal activity involved in the way the business represented its, you know, values for tax purposes of various real estate holdings, represented its the values of the business, you know, for banks when they're applying for loans, that's ongoing, and that won't stop when the president leaves office. And if his tax returns are relevant to the criminal prosecution, if there is one of anybody from the businesses, including the president, then those would come out in that context. But again, the next stage of this in the Manhattan criminal case is going to be another round in the courts, which I think will probably go fairly quickly. Then there will be a grand jury investigation, which will be secret. And at the end of that process, if there are no criminal indictments, then none of this will be disclosed. If there are criminal indictments, then to the extent this information, you know, is relevant for the prosecution, then the information, including the president's tax returns, could come out at that point.
Let me give you a hypothetical, and we'll go back to the Congress, since you make a great point in that once the election is over, and we are not making any predictions here, but let's say that President Trump is defeated, it would lessen the motivation in theory for Congress to go forward. But because this president has the first, in recent memory, to not reveal any financial records, and because he didn't technically break any laws by not doing that, would there, in your view, could there be a possible motivation to codify this into law, and therefore you would want to see these particular records in order to justify having such a law going forward?
Yeah, that's a very good point. So it's one can easily imagine that if President Trump is defeated, and particularly if the Democrats are in control of the House or the Senate or both, Congress will consider passing a law to require presidential candidates to disclose their tax returns. And if Congress is looking into legislation, if it's considering legislation to require presidents to release their tax returns, the president's tax returns could still be relevant for Congress's consideration of legislation on exactly that issue. And so Congress might continue to have a legitimate legislative purpose in seeking those records, if it's considering legislation like that.
You know, looking at the nation's founding, there was always, in my view, an implied assumption that there was a collective commitment to the success of the experiment. Would it be fair to suggest that, at least on the issue of taxes, that the president and his legal team seems to have found a loophole that sort of exploits that commitment?
Well, I mean, let me put that in historical perspective a bit. So it really wasn't until, I believe, President Carter that presidential candidates disclosed their tax returns. So this is a norm that has developed, you know, since the mid-1970s. Mm-hmm. Now, all the presidential candidates of the major parties before Donald Trump did follow this norm. But it's a norm that, you know, got established in the wake of Watergate and the, you know, various problems with President Nixon's second term and the re-election and all of the criminal matters involved with that, that this norm developed. I think it's certainly a good norm. The fact that President Trump defied it and didn't seem to have major electoral consequences, at least in the sense that he got elected, means that Congress may very well decide that they need to codify this norm, you know, to put it into legislation. But it is one of a number of post-Watergate reforms to the system, some through legislation, some through new understandings of what's proper and appropriate, the importance of transparency, and the like. But it's not something that, you know, we can say goes back, you know, to the start of the income tax.
I'd like to have you talk about this in a broader sense, but this seems to be a continuation of a trend that the legislative branch and the executive branch have been unable to fulfill a certain thing. And so they have put it on the judiciary to solve it. And that seems to be antithetical to where our whole system of checks and balances was created. And not just this case, but talk about that in the larger sense. Am I on to something here?
So I think one way of looking at this is that the polarization of the political parties in the U.S. in the modern era, sort of began in the late 70s, early 1980s, and it's been getting worse and worse and worse every sort of election cycle. And now, as we know, I've called this in my writing hyper-polarized democracy in America. That's a sort of a play on de Tocqueville's Democracy in America. Now what we have is hyper-polarized democracy in America. And so when the president is from one party and either the House or the Senate is controlled by the opposite party, we have these conflicts that at one time could be worked out through various accommodations and compromises and negotiations, and now just are totally intractable. And then President Trump carried that to a level we've never seen before by simply defying or ordering his aides to not respond to all of these congressional subpoenas and taking a kind of a blanket, scorched earth approach to this, which almost inevitably puts Congress in the position of turning to the courts because there's just no basis for negotiation, for discussion. They're just at such a polarized and confrontational place that it's somewhat inevitable, I think, the courts are going to be drawn into that picture. Is that the way it was designed to work? No, the courts were never designed to be such central players on so many sorts of issues. But when politics are so polarized that government across different parties in control of different parts of the government can't really effectively work together at all, it's just not surprising that you're going to see the courts drawn into these conflicts. Now, you know, that was interesting backdrop here because, as I say, the president's defense here was, or part of his argument was, look, this has always been left outside the courts. Don't get involved. And the Supreme Court here said, and I think probably recognizing that background reality of how our political culture works or doesn't work these days, decided that it was important and appropriate for the court to actually play this role, bring some clarity, establish what the basic legal principles are here that are in play. And I think that clarity does provide a benefit to the system. Now, you know, each institution has a much better sense of what it can and cannot do.
I guess just following that, though, in that larger sense, doesn't this whole dysfunction that you just outlined create the self-fulfilling prophecy? Aha! The courts are legislating from the bench. When you have this dysfunction, doesn't that bring that criticism as well?
Yes, absolutely. There are a couple of things that kind of come into play when we have such a gridlocked and polarized political system. So if Congress and the president can't, for example, develop legislation on major issues that are high up on the list of sort of public demands for action, then it's entirely predictable that a couple of things will happen. One, people will turn to the courts and see if the courts can be brought into the mix. And secondly, administrative agencies are going to end up being empowered because they will be the ones who start taking action, even in the absence of congressional legislation or new congressional legislation under old statutes. Agencies may start being more assertive in certain areas. And, you know, both of those are problematic. You know, one way of thinking about this larger story is when our system was designed with separation of powers and three different pieces of the national political system, the House, the Senate, and the presidency, the framers of the Constitution didn't anticipate the rise of political parties. And once we got political parties, and once they became so polarized, as they are in the modern era, then these institutions really function more in partisan terms than, you know, in terms of some competing views of the national interest. And so if there's a Republican president, a Democratic House is going to be, you know, adamant in opposing in many ways, but same as vice, you know, true when a Democratic president's in, a Republican Senate going to be, you know, deeply dug in opposition. And this poses a huge challenge to the kind of separation of power system that we have. You know, can this separated power system function with such polarized divisions in the parties? If different parties control different parts of the national government, or are we just going to be paralyzed? And a big part of the story of the polarization that's emerged relentlessly ever since it began in the late 70s or early 80s is that the political process has been frozen in many respects. And that's a very bad thing for democracy in America, because people are going to get frustrated, they're going to get alienated if big issues are not being addressed. They will turn to these less democratic entities, the administrative agencies or the courts. But my fear, even more broadly, is that, you know, at some point, if the political process is not responding to public demands for policy, whether it's on environmental issues or immigration issues or healthcare issues or tax policy, whatever it might be, if these are major issues that the political process is not capable of addressing, you know, the ultimate worry is, do people get actually alienated from the democratic process itself? You know, I think that's definitely something one has to worry about. So I don't know when we will get out of this hyper-polarized dynamic between the parties. There's certainly no basis for thinking that's going to change anytime in the immediate future.
I want to read to you a quote from Justice Brennan, and this was in a case involving William Proxmire, and Justice Brennan said, quote, speaking about congressional investigations, investigation conducted solely to punish the investigated, either by publicly or prosecution, is indefensible. It exceeds the congressional power. Exposure for the sake of exposure is not legislative inquiry. In your view, how close was Congress to encroaching on Justice Brennan's concern?
Yeah, well, that's a difficult and an interesting question. So Congress certainly, you know, doesn't have the power, though they have the temptation, you know, to want to harass and hamstring a president of the opposing party. There's no question. We recognize Congress's temptation and incentives to do that. The Supreme Court in this decision is very sensitive to exactly what you quote from Justice Brennan there, And that's why the Supreme Court in this decision with respect to Congress says a congressional subpoena has to have a legitimate legislative purpose, meaning it has to be connected to Congress's consideration of potential legislation. What the line is between considering legislation and exposing what's gone on inside the executive branch, you know, that can be a thin line, to be sure. But if the courts were to conclude these, you know, subpoenas or any congressional subpoenas were purely for harassment purposes, purely for partisan political purposes, that would be beyond Congress's powers under this decision in the congressional case, and consistent, this case being consistent with what Justice Brennan said there in the Proxmire case.
Finally, does it frustrate you as a constitutional law professor when you have these high profile cases debated on television that it is almost, does it ever feel totally unrelated to what the issues were when it's being debated in the public discourse, and that sort of influences how the public discourse views a particular case?
Well, I'll say two things. First, about these cases, I think the public commentary has actually been relatively good, at least the stuff I've seen. You know, both sides are, you know, try to spin these decisions towards their interests, and that's kind of to be predicted. But I think on these decisions, partly because they are fairly straightforward, to me, from what I've seen, it's the commentary has been reasonably solid. But what you point out here is absolutely true. It's very frustrating often to see the way Supreme Court decisions are commented on, and not just by people who don't necessarily understand the law, you know, in our polarized culture, a lot of the commentary has also become extremely polarized, and so people commenting on these decisions, you know, have the sky is falling in, you know, one direction or the other direction reactions. And I think those are, in many contexts I've seen, certainly not nuanced, not appreciative of the legal principles. You know, particularly with a Chief Justice like Chief Justice Roberts, who tends to be very kind of incremental in the way he's comfortable deciding cases, there could be small but critical points and distinctions that often just get blown through in the kind of commentary that we have. Of course, you go on the internet now and you can find anybody you want for any view you want. So that does make it difficult to have these decisions kind of be understood and, you know, in their proper terms. So that is a real concern, absolutely, and a frustration.
Well, you just gave me a great idea. Instead of having you on with your constitutional expertise, I will just forego that in the future and just interview myself. I have no law degree, but I have passed a local tavern, so I've passed the bar. So, unfortunately, that sounds like that's where we're headed, right?
that is part of what's happened with social media and, you know, the kind of world we live in these days. You know, there's no filtering gatekeeper kind of structures anymore. The more inflammatory, the more outraged, the more, you know, clicks things get, and then the more people see that, and the more they're fed that, you know, that's we're all aware of the problem that poses for our political culture, and it's also something that's a problem for commentary on Supreme Court decisions.
So this show isn't, and this interview is actually, we're dinosaurs because no one yelled at each other. We just had a judicious conversation. Richard Pildes, NYU constitutional law professor, former clerk to Justice Thurgood Marshall. Thank you, sir, for joining me today on the Public Morality. I much appreciated it.
Well, and I always like doing your show for exactly this reason, that we can have extended discussions and not little sound bites. So thank you for hosting a show like this.
I want to thank today's guest, law professor Richard Pildes. The Public Morality welcomes your comments. You can contact me at Byron@publicmorality.org. That's Byron, B-Y-R-O-N, @publicmorality.org. You can follow me on Facebook as well as Twitter. The archive broadcast can be found on iTunes and SoundCloud. Once again, I want to thank Elvin Jenkins and Michael Burns at WJAB in Huntsville, Alabama, for allowing us to broadcast the Public Morality at their studios. The Public Morality is produced at WSNC on the campus of Winston-Salem State University. And in the words of Martin Luther King, we may have come on different ships, but we're in the same boat now. For all of us at the Public Morality, I'm Byron Williams.